but we tried and said, what other things could we consider? I was pleased to see in the proposed report that one of the things that's being involved is a potential surcharge on the ticket taxes. That's spectator fund. But other than a bigger contribution from the private parties, we couldn't come up with anything. And since we had concluded that in principle some use of urban renewal funds was acceptable, especially with the support of the local area and PDC and the council, that's we stayed with that. And there is public benefit to these projects too, which can justify some of that.
When I got a briefing last week from Ken Rust, he explained that the money coming out of an urban renewal district on the east side, which would be in the form of zero coupon bonds, but because of the nature of the district, it is a district that where the costs of that increment are not carried by other jurisdictions. There's no impact on Multnomah County or any other taxing authority because of the kind of urban renewal district it is. On the west side, it's a more traditional urban renewal district where there is some cost. I'd like to shift for a moment to the revenue projections. And I just want to make sure that I understand that the revenue projections for Major League Soccer at PG Park and for baseball, as I understand it, were based on a pro forma prepared by Shortstop LLC. Is that correct?
Yes, and then reviewed by the city consultants, and we heard a report from the city consultants on that. Okay. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to come back to that in a second. There was a press report recently raising the question of why Miami, Montreal, and Atlanta passed on Major League Soccer. What struck me about all three cities is that they are established venues for other professional teams. If I'm correct, they each have a professional football and baseball team. In the case of Montreal, it's a CFL, not NFL. Do you have an opinion as to, let me state it differently, is there anything about their experience which is instructive in terms of how we review this proposal? In other words, is there something that they learned about this that we need to consider as we evaluate it?
Well, I guess based on, and others from the task force, you should ask that question as well, based on what we heard reasonable arguments that the Portland market could support two significant or major league franchises. There'd be questions about a third. So we had some evidence from credible sources that a second major league franchise could be viable and successful here. So the concern is how deep and large is the market and how many of those kinds of entertainment options would be successful from a business sense in this model, meaning can the proponent pay the rent and generate the funds into the spectator fund. I think, you know, I haven't followed the details of those other cities very well, and I know that one of the cities remaining in contention for one of the Major League Soccer franchises, I think it's St. Louis, is having trouble because they don't have a major private sponsor for their proposal. So you kind of have in place, as Mayor Adams said, Portland has a committed private sponsor, which is a kind of an unusual asset. So you sort of have to ask yourself, do you have the private support? That would be something that you need to be concerned about. Otherwise, I'm not sufficiently aware of the details of why those cities pulled out.
Mayor, if I could ask one more question.
Sure.
This is very helpful for me. Was a market research survey done gauging demand for MLS in this region?
I don't know, and that's an excellent question. I would say that, you know, the task force, we would like to have had more information. There's no question. You always want more information, but you never have all the information that you want. We would have liked to have – we got some market research data, so it's sort of like a qualified yes or no, depending how you frame it. We got a lot of market research information that compared the Portland market to comparable and other markets. And we kept asking for more. And what we would have liked to have seen was an in-the-field market research study of demand for soccer and AAA baseball. We had the history of AAA baseball, which is very helpful. That's hard data. You're projecting on the Major League Soccer. One of the things that was most persuasive to many of us on the task force was we finally were able to get some hard data on how much attendance at soccer games increased in cities that went from a Timbers League type of to Major League Soccer. And that was pretty hard data that suggested attendance would triple or quadruple, which made the proponents' projections much more credible. But that was only one piece. We kept trying to get more market. But we either the city didn't have we didn't have the time to put a study like that in the field, and we didn't get one from the proponents.
And it's one reason why the guarantee that we'll talk about in just a minute, why the guarantee, which was part of
Absolutely.
Your conditions, why you made that condition on your recommendation.
So if I unless Commissioner Fish has got another question.
No, Mr. Mazur, thank you very much.
I wanted to illuminate the point that you just made, which is a very significant point. The question that Commissioner Fish had regarding the pro forma, the projected amount of attendees, the fan base, is interesting, but fortunately for our discussion, quite irrelevant, because we entered into an agreement with the owner that guarantees he will make the payments to PGE Park and to the AAA Stadium, whether there's one fan or 25,000 fans. Our economic interests are met through the personal guarantee he's made to make those payments, and doesn't really change our bottom line at all. So that's a very, very significant part of this agreement that must be considered as we have this debate today.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Well, thank you for your work and the committee. So the committee took sort of as a basic parameter that a new URA was part of the mix, and then so you didn't have to get in sort of the politics of forming urban renewal areas. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
I think we assumed there were processes in place to accomplish that, and we're relying on that.
So when you talked a lot about the committee's charge to, you know, and the committee being very risk-averse with respect to the city's general fund, you didn't get into issues around urban renewal and its impact on, say, county or school district general
funds. I wouldn't say that we got too deeply into that, and again, on the presumption that the council itself is one of the key decision makers and may not be the only one, but it's sort of within your control to influence what happens there. And so if you were to decide to do that, then we would rely on that. That would be your judgment.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions for Steve? Thank you, Mr. Chair. You did a fantastic
Thanks
job.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear.
Could I just?
The fire marshal doesn't like people standing up in the back anywhere in the room. So if you could squeeze together, and let folks sit. That includes you down here as well. They don't like us standing. Chair Wheeler, you can stand, but you can stand, but nobody else. All right. So we're now going to get a briefing on exactly what are we considering today. And if I could please have four people come forward. So we'll need to grab another chair. Steve Janik, Ken Russ, Dave Logston, and Lou Bowers.
So did we read both of these together, 225 and 226?
Why don't we do the second ones? Thank you. Read the title for 226.
226, declare city support for Peregrine LLC's bid to bring a Major League Soccer franchise to the City of Portland and authorize Peregrine LLC to present a financing package to Major League Soccer.
And just before you move on, just a matter of procedure.
Yep.
The item 226 is a placeholder, a generically crafted placeholder. I have here the substitute resolution along with the addendum that can be
moved
and substituted. I would recommend that we do that now so we're actually discussing the actual deal.
Okay, and I just want to disclaimer to the audience, this is a procedural vote on substitution of what we're actually considering today for a placeholder that was on the council agenda. Does not any vote, the substitution vote up here does not indicate support or lack of support for the eventual vote on the substance of the resolution. So it has been moved. Do I hear a second? Second. It's been moved and seconded on the substitution.
And this is for discussion purposes only. It doesn't commit one to...
So now we have a discussion on this?
Actually, if we can't discuss it until we adopt it as the item that we're actually discussing.
I don't mean the discussion on the substance of it. I just want to ask a question before we move an amendment. Is this materially different than what I was given on Monday as
no.
a draft?
Materially different? No.
Are there differences?
We will get you will be pointed out by
no, it, what it
Steve
does
Janik
is
the difference.
If you look at the language,
he's talking about this.
I understand that. Okay. If you look at the language, it reflects what the TA agreement was between the parties on Monday.
And we'll walk through it, this portion of the presentation in detail. But I would like to get it on the floor so that we're considering this.
I'm still confused as to what we're voting on here. The reason for this
is a parliamentary procedure whereby you can't literally discuss something that's not before us.
So we
actually don't
before.
Have the agreement before us. We introduced a placeholder, understanding that today we would have the final language to place before us. So to actually have the discussion we're pretending to have, we have to adopt this,
Thank you.
doesn't commit anybody to support it when we vote.
Thank you.
All right. Any additional discussion? Anyone want to testify on the amendment? Carla, please call the roll.
Ritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Do we have two of them or just one? Just the one?
You have the resolution and then an addendum.
We only have one. Yeah, we only need to amend one thing, but right.
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Janik, welcome to the City Council. Glad you're here. Please give us your first and last name.
Good morning, members of the City Council. My name is Steve Janik. I'm a lawyer. I've been acting as outside counsel to the city on this transaction in conjunction with working with the city attorney's office. The resolution that is before you is not a legally binding agreement. Rather, it sets forth the basic terms of a proposed transaction with Mr. Paulson. If this resolution passes, the process that we will be going through will be to negotiate the definitive documents, and we plan to bring those before the council not later than August 1st. Within those documents, there will be numerous contingencies that must be satisfied before the city has any legally binding obligation to do this transaction. And it's our hope that we will be able to have those contingencies either resolved or not by September 1. And it will not be until you are completely satisfied with all of the contingencies that you will have any binding obligation. The process that we've seen here is very similar to what we went through when we did the Rose Garden transaction. It started with a citizen advisory committee. At that time, it was called the Blue Ribbon Task Force. And the city advisory committee evaluated the proposal and set out the very broad concepts, the criteria, and the standards to guide the transaction. We then entered into a memorandum of agreement, which is non-binding, similar to the resolution that is before you today. And there then ensued, unfortunately, months of difficult negotiations that ultimately concluded in the definitive documents that again contained contingencies where the city had to be absolutely satisfied before the city was obligated to proceed. That's the same thing that we'll be doing here. Now, in terms of the overview of the transaction and its financing, as I think you all know, the total amount of the proposed transaction is $129 million, which includes the $40 million fee that is charged by MLS for the acquisition of the franchise and the team. Mr. Paulson will be paying that $40 million, so that brings us down to $89 million in construction costs for renovating PG Park and building a new AAA stadium. Let's talk about who puts what into that $89 million pot. The city's obligation is threefold. First, the deal proposes that if the new West Side downtown urban renewal area is formed, then of that apparently about $500 million worth of bondable value, $15 million would be allocated to this transaction. Secondly, out of the existing Oregon Convention Center Urban Renewal District, where there is bonding capacity of approximately $26 million, $18.5 million of that capacity will be used to sell tax increment-backed bonds. Third, we have the Spectator Facilities Fund, which you've heard about in Steve Mazur's report. That is a fund that really originated primarily out of the Rose Garden transaction, where the city, by contract, charges a user fee of 6% on every ticket sold. And the funds that go into that Spectator Facility account are to be used for what its name indicates, namely city-owned Spectator Facilities. Within that Spectators Facility Fund today is a capital reserve of about $2.5 million, which I'll be talking about in a moment. That capital reserve is required to be used for, it, again, its namesake purpose, which is capital improvements to the city's own Spectator Facilities. In addition, now we have Mr. Paulson's contributions. Toward the $89 million capital cost, Mr. Paulson has to write a check for starting with $12.5 million. Secondly, Mr. Paulson has to raise or otherwise contribute to this fund the remaining $11.8 million. As to those two dollar amounts, the city has absolutely no obligation, no contingent obligation, no backup obligation, no obligation. And as you can see, because of the three bonding sources we are using, the general fund dollars are not being used, the general fund dollars are not being pledged, and the city's financial obligation is capped. Now, out of PGE Park, the original deal, where we looked at achieving upside for the city's investment, we learned the lesson that it's very difficult to rely upon some projections, market estimates, or anything else. In this deal, we have gone a different direction. We have looked to achieve the highest degree of certainty that what this transaction, what these teams will contribute to the Spectator Facility Fund will be absolutely assured. What these teams will contribute to the Spectator Facilities Fund will be rent on the new AAA baseball stadium, rent on the new Major League Soccer stadium, the user fee on every ticket sold at either of these facilities. And that user fee, Mr. Paulson has agreed to increase it from 6% to 7%. And he has also agreed to guarantee for 25 years the agreed-upon projected amount of rent, which increases over time, the agreed-upon projected user fees to come out of both facilities. And he's agreed to do so even if nobody shows up. Even if the league folds, it will be an unconditional personal guarantee of Mr. Paulson and his family. Now, what this takes away from the city is the risk of how these businesses operate and whether they succeed. That was a risk that we participated in PGE Park, and it didn't work out. That's one of the most fundamental changes in this transaction, and it reflects the directive of the city council, the directive of the task force to find a way to make this such that the general funds would never be at risk. Now, some may be unfamiliar with guarantees. Hopefully you've never had to sign any. But a guarantee means what it says. It's legally enforceable, it's unconditional, and it's not difficult to enforce. It's a simple issue. Did you meet your obligation to pay the agreed-upon amount of the user fees? If not, you guaranteed it, write a check. In addition to that, the people who will be on this guarantee have very, very substantial net worth, as has been publicly reported. But as we did in the Rose Garden transaction, we will be reviewing their financial statements to make sure of the accuracy and the depth of that resource. The only other matter I'd like to talk about is cost overruns. As I noted before, the city has $2.5 million in hand in the capital reserve account. And in negotiating how we split up the risk of cost overruns, we have to recognize two things. Number one, the budget estimates we have now are just that, they're estimates. Number two, these are city-owned facilities, and the city will get the benefit of these facilities forever. So consequently, if there is some cost overrun, what we looked at, again, was capping the city's risk. And we have capped the cost overrun risk at the existing $2.5 million that we now have. Above that, Mr. Paulson is responsible for all cost overruns beyond that amount, whatever they might be. The city has no sort of contingent liability on any other portion of the cost overrun amounts. So I think we have crafted a transaction here that protects the general fund as we were directed to do, alleviates any concern we have on how profitable these businesses might be or operate, and we've seized the opportunity to take advantage of an excellent partner, a partner who has made a strong commitment by already buying teams here and who has the financial strength to back up these commitments. Now, again, as I started, I pointed out that this is just the beginning, and there will be no legally binding agreement until we come back to you if this resolution passes months from now with a big stack of documents for you to approve. Within those documents will be a number of important contingencies that the city has to be satisfied with before you're obligated to proceed. And let me just mention a few of them. First, the documents themselves. The devil's always in the detail, and unfortunately we'll be asking you to look at the detail. Next, you have to approve the plans and the specifications. It's not as though you're going to simply take a hands-off approach and let someone else design it. And that goes beyond your normal design review function, because these are going to be city-owned facilities. Next, you have to approve the construction contract itself, and you have to approve the contractor. Again, as I mentioned, we'd have to review the financial strength behind the guarantees. You have to decide politically whether you want to form the new Downtown West Urban Renewal Area. And with respect to the bonds that we've mentioned here, you would have to make the determination that they are marketable. We will not be obligated unless the bonds can be sold. And then finally, there would have to be unconditional proof of the commitment of the Paulson contributions. So those are the most important, I think, of the contingencies that would have to be met before we have a binding deal. So if you have any questions,
we're going to hear from everybody and then take questions. Ken, can you talk through the zero coupon bond, why this doesn't raid any county, city, or school district or port on the OCC side, and then talk about sort of the net costs of the tax increment on the west side, potential tax increment on the west side, and just your general overall take on the financial picture here?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Ken Rust. I'm the director of the Office of Management and Finance and the city's chief administrative officer, and probably the unspoken title for this transaction is the chief financial worrier for the city. Really, there are three risk areas that I'm concerned about. Steve's done a very good job of outlining them for you. There's business risk associated with the transaction. There's financing risk that would be imposed on the city in terms of being able to deliver funds. And then there's this construction cost risk. And I'm going to dismiss the last one first because it's the easiest one. We do have a firm dollar amount, $2.5 million, very unique, very positive for the city. And we haven't always had the best of luck with construction projects. And I can only imagine a tram project that started at $15 million and ended at $17.5 million for us. I think we'd all be a lot happier about that project. So that's a very significant element. In terms of the business risk, this is also a unique transaction in that we really do have for the PG Park and the new AAA baseball stadium venue, a guarantee of the projected revenues that the city would receive. You know, this is akin to a take-or-pay kind of contract that we've used elsewhere for the hydroelectric project, for example, that puts the burden on a third party to deliver us revenues regardless of what happens, which is an extremely good position for us to be in. And so that's an important part of the way we've been looking at this transaction, trying to make sure that we can manage that risk, because we do know that from our experience that there are risks involved, and the best set of projections are simply a set of projections. I think it is important to note, however, that you know, part of the financing right now is based on about $31 million of Spectator Facilities Fund bonds. These would be bonds that would be backed by the general fund but would expected to be paid for from Spectator Facilities revenues, a financing technique that we've used very successfully for all of the Rose Quarter development to this point. It assures us the best access to capital at the lowest possible prices. Because not all of those revenues are from the baseball or soccer-related venue, it's important for the city to realize that about $20 million or so of the $31 million of financing really represents future revenues to be generated from Rose Quarter facilities, primarily the Rose Garden. And so we do have the risk that those forecasts may not turn out to be as accurate, and that's a risk that we have to be careful about and manage, as we have since we went into the relationship with the Blazers for the Rose Quarter project back in 1995. So I think it's important to note that that is not covered by the Paulson Family Guarantee. In terms of financing risks, right now we have both Spectator Facilities Fund financing and the Convention Center Urban Renewal District financings require us to issue zero coupon bonds, bonds that basically defer the payment of interest till maturity. And that helps us structure around the cash flow that's present for both the Spectator Facilities Fund primarily and in the Urban Renewal District. That transaction, we've done those kinds of bonds in the past. Right now, the credit market conditions are extremely poor. In fact, the worst credit market conditions I've ever seen in my professional career. So the ability to tap into those markets reliably is a question mark. Obviously, if we can't access the market, we are not going to be obligated to deliver those funds. But that's right now is going to be a very difficult transaction to execute under the current market conditions that we're facing. Hopefully, over time, they will improve, but it's going to take a lot of work to make that happen, and I couldn't tell you today that we will be successful with that. And with respect to the Convention Center Urban Renewal District, that district is an Option 3 district, and the revenues for that Urban Renewal District are capped. We have a fixed divide the tax component. We have a special levy element that's allocated to that Urban Renewal District, so revenues do not grow for that Urban Renewal District, regardless of how much additional increment may be created. And each dollar of additional increment that is created in that district is released back to the overlapping tax jurisdictions as if it didn't exist today. So the county, the city, all overlapping jurisdictions today currently reap the benefit of the decision that the city made post-Measure 47/50 to treat that area as an Option 3 district. So for purposes of going forward, there is no impact whatsoever on the county by the decision that the city would make to use $18.5 million of tax increment from the Convention Center Urban Renewal District. And it also does not crowd out any existing projects that are currently slated to be constructed or are in the PDC budget because it's utilizing this zero coupon bond structure and not affecting what's already planned to be executed with a current interest bond financing that has been in the works with PDC for some time. So those are important things to note with the Convention Center piece of the financing plan. The last piece is probably one of the most difficult ones for us to get our hands around now, and that's the to-be-formed district. Clearly, the city, in order to be able to feel comfortable that it can commit the $15 million, which would have to be done with a general fund-backed short-term line of credit borrowing taken out as tax increment revenues are generated in the district after its formation, we have to have some certainty that that district will be formed and that we have to know that what the terms and conditions of that district will be so that we are comfortable assuming that financial risk. So that is something that the council will have to be watching and determining, you know, how it wants to approach that financing risk. We've had very good success doing those kinds of things for other projects. A good example of that is the Interstate Urban Renewal District, where the city made a commitment of $30 million of match for the light rail before that district really was formed. We executed a general fund-backed financing with the plan that it would be paid off within 5 years, some increment generated in that district, and we were successful with that within the time frame that we expected. So that's the kind of thing that we would have to do here, but the fact that the district has not yet been formed does impose some unique risks to us that we should be mindful of. So those are the things that I worry about. There's a lot of work to be done. We are at the start of making these things happen, but our success depends on a lot of other factors that have to be executed after today's meeting.
David, could you talk about in Exhibit A, the community events, Veterans Memorial, Good Neighbor Agreement, SDC, sustainability and availability of Memorial Coliseum, sort of the non-financial aspects of the proposed agreement?
Certainly, Mayor. For the record, David Logsdon, Spectator Facilities Manager. I think some of these elements address some of the broader community benefits that would be a part of this transaction. The Mayor Paulson has established a foundation when he first came to Portland and acquired the current businesses at PG Park. He has made investments in youth sports and would continue to do so, would continue to increase his contribution to youth sports programs and facilities. under this new arrangement with his foundation. He's also agreed to continue the practice that exists currently at PG Park of having the facility available for community events and for activities of local high school athletic programs, in particular at PG Park. Now he has a close relationship with Lincoln, and they do a lot of practicing at PG Park currently. Those kinds of activities would be emphasized and continued at both facilities. Ultimately, a development at the Rose Quarter could impact the existing Veterans Memorial. We see that as a very critical piece of any development project in the quarter, and would work, you know, diligently along with the Paulson interests and veterans communities to design and locate an appropriate memorial that would continue the theme of a Veterans Memorial within the Rose Quarter. Good neighbor agreements are a part of these kind of large facility developments of the city. There is an existing good neighbor agreement at PG Park that would need to be opened up and modified with the transition to Major League Soccer, and we would look at a similar type of structure and process for the siting of the new baseball facility. There will be an emphasis on sustainability within the project, both in terms of the construction activities and in terms of operations. I think we found that the Mayor Paulson has a very strong environmental interest. I think he is well-positioned and well-motivated to implement both in terms of a construction phase and with the operations of his businesses and facilities to have a strong emphasis on environmentally sustainable practices. So I think that covers it.
Thank you. Lou, do you want to talk about any issues that have not been aired out related to tax increment? Including the discussions that we've had around the table that we would use between now and a year from now to go through the process. We have agreements with the school district for consultation. We have agreements with the county for consultation, and that this does not create a tax increment district.
That's correct. My name is Lou Bowers. I'm the manager of the Central City Division for the Portland Development Commission. As Commissioner Fish was getting into, if you wanted to proceed with this, I assume what you'd want to do would be to either recommend or direct to the next stage, a public process, which would be a discussion of a new Central City urban rural area. And this project would be one that could be considered. We anticipate that would probably be a 6 to 9 month conversation looking at a variety of areas. The ones you've directed us to look at include the Conway area, the Goose Hollow area, which would include this, the area around Portland State University, and the downtown retail core. So those are the parts of the discussion. And
potentially the Lincoln High School site.
Lincoln High School would be part of the Goose Hollow, correct, right, within that area. And then this would be part of a proposal that would come back to you as should there be a new urban renewal district, what should be the boundaries of it, and what should be the key projects. So as Ken Russ said, it is not unprecedented for you to direct that you would like certain projects to be included and see if that works within the proposal. In terms of the OCC, because of the unique financing, as Ken described, this money is not currently in the OCC budget. So this would be part of the budget process of, in fact, amending the budget and increasing the amount available by the amount of this financing. And that's due to the unique nature of this financing, that it would not be available to the district except for this potential private placement of the bonds.
So I thank Council for their patience, and now let's open it up to questions.
Questions?
Commissioner Saltzman.
I guess maybe it's to Lou. How do you have a good faith discussion with the school district and the county about whether to create a new URA, urban renewal area, how much indebtedness it will be when we've already, maybe today, committed $15 million of that? How do you have those good faith discussions?
My understanding is you have committed that the county and the school district will be part of those discussions. So the process is going forward, they would be at the table to have those discussions. So it would be upfront.
Don't support the idea of forming a new urban renewal area?
That'd be part of the
discussion. We sort of jumped ahead of them then, haven't we?
I believe the financing commitment is contingent on the approval of a new urban renewal area. So if that were not to come about, you would not be obligated, obviously, to use urban renewal because you wouldn't have it.
Well, that's also a sort of a city council level question to begin the process. And those processes are usually led by a partnership between PDC and the Bureau, now Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So we would come to the city council to initiate that process and what that process would look like. But it is not uncommon for this council to have sort of a desire, including the potential for projects, having been involved with the interstate creation of the interstate urban renewal district. The council did so with some expectations, but also we put players at the table, as we would hear, that would be opposed to the very creation of the district itself, and that kind of discussion I think is important to have.
Well, and I guess I would point out these decisions aren't strictly the council's anymore. You know, we've been litigated over our past two decisions on urban renewal areas, so we do have, you know, some other people at the table. Salem is looking closely at what to do about urban renewal areas statewide. A lot of that discussion is driven by what happens in Portland. So we're not the only, you know, we don't have total control over our destiny on that anymore. And that's, I'm not asking, that's not the question.
But we do have control over the process we set up to consider this issue.
Right. Ken, when are the zero coupon bonds for the Spectator Fund and for the Oregon Convention Center urban renewal portion to be sold? Is there a timeline in the agreement?
Well, the current agreement, as I understand now, and Steve can correct me if I'm wrong, requires us to basically have our financing commitments pretty much locked in by September 1 of this year, if I read it correctly. So we would have to, you know, begin that work pretty soon, and we would determine, you know, whether that's doable or not. And now, if that doesn't work, there's a process to, I think, change or amend the schedule, recognizing that if we're making our best efforts at it, which is our obligation to perform under the agreement, that they may simply take more time. But the plan right now is, I think, to try to move things along quickly to be able to hit a certain schedule for opening the soccer facility, assuming that the franchise is awarded to Merit's group.
So the ideal schedule is by September 1 to have, I'm guess I'm not quite sure what you said, the bonds would be marketed?
Well,
issued?
You know, I guess, and Steve can discuss this as well, if we have an obligation to the ideal thing would be for us to have the bonds sold and have the bonds closed and in our hands prior to any date that requires us to be able to deliver those funds so that we know that we can honor our obligation. The way that the...
So is that prior to September 1st or...
Or prior to our on December, September 1st, we have the bonds issued and we would have a closing. So we would know that we could deliver on that particular contract element if that was what we were obligated to do. Or we would have agreed that we will have... we will mutually agree that we'll take more time, we'll reset that schedule.
So what happens if we issue those bonds, the zero coupon bonds, they're issued, sold, and we, you know, we're not clear on, and we're still having our process about whether to create a new urban renewal area, and so therefore, and maybe litigation or legislation may impede that process, and we can't deliver on the specified schedule for the $15 million from the new to be formed urban renewal area, is that a risk that we would have bonds issued and
no.
then we couldn't deliver on the...
No, Commissioner, the definitive documents will basically provide that either the city has secured all of its three funding sources or we don't proceed. So if we find ourselves in a circumstance where, let's say, we've determined by September 1 that the OCC TIF bonds are saleable, that the spectator facility bonds have been sold or there's a contract for their sale, but the new urban renewal area has not yet been formed, then we will not be obligated to proceed. And what we will have to do is sit down with Mr. Paulson and say, we've got to change plans. We've got to delay this. And that will mean that instead of opening the facilities in 2011, it may slide to 2012. And that's the reality of it. And
any litigation that would be aimed at whether creating a new urban renewal area in Southwest Portland is, in fact, curing urban blight, that would... Any kind of litigation like that would...
But also delay it as well.
Would delay.
That's right. That's right.
Any
so,
decisions.
So the city would never be caught in a situation where a portion of your funds have been committed, you've sold bonds, but then the other piece isn't there. All has to come together completely secure before the city is obligated to proceed.
And we would not want to issue bonds if that wasn't the case, because trying to unwind that after the fact, if we were stalled kind of midway through... would be extremely difficult and expensive. And, you know, I would not advise that to the council.
Just clarifying question on the OCC, what part of your testimony was that given the nature of the kind of district that accessing that available debt that it would other remain unaccessed and sort of expire, the value of which would expire, is it fair to say that if we get more development going there and get more value added in terms of development going in OCC and the city, the county, and school districts in the port will then get more property taxes because they get the money off of that? Is there a potential upside for what we're proposing at OCC?
Yes, in fact, it's all upside. If any additional dollar of new increment is created, all of it is released to the overlapping jurisdictions as if that urban renewal district did not exist. That's the way the Option 3 district and the decision we made allows for governments to share. And a tremendous amount of increment assessed value has been released from the city's Option 3 district since that decision was made.
So the more development, the more we can get the Rose Quarter going, and we're in negotiations with Blazers right now on a framework agreement as well that will be coming forward to council in the next couple of months for their consideration. We have issues of headquarters hotel that we're looking at as a possibility. The Schlesingers have a property development proposal in the district as well. That's all upside.
As long as it's taxable development, yes.
Correct. Thank you. The other question I had on the, what kind of a, under law, if we were to create a new urban renewal district on the west side, and it would have the 30% set aside for affordable housing, which these neighborhoods have asked for more affordable housing and a whole bunch of other stuff, what kind of tax increment district would it be?
My understanding is it will be the first district formed under the most restrictive set of tax increment rules, so it will be different than the ones that we currently have. And by that, I mean, I believe the way the new districts work, and maybe Lou can correct me if I'm wrong, is that when we start the consolidated tax rate that's used to produce the tax revenues against the increment assessed value, will include special levies that exist at the time of formation, but as they wear away or as new levies are created, they are not included in the consolidated tax rate. And also, the consolidated tax rate does not include the amount of taxes associated with voter-approved general obligation bond levies. So that piece is stripped away as well. So the sum of the consolidated taxes that are part of the rate that produces the revenues is less and will stay less than the other districts that we currently operate.
Other questions? Commissioner Fritz.
I just wanted to comment to everybody who's waiting to testify that I've been in your position many times, and the reason that it's important for you to stay, if you can, is that we're still getting some of this information for the first time, and so we want you to be informed on what's on the table so that you can inform your testimony. But I do appreciate you all being here and waiting. Mr. Janet, you are working for the city in this instance, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so one question I had, I just wanted to clarify that too. In the task force report, the projected cost of the baseball stadium is at the Rose Quarter is $87 million, and it's now $89 million. Can you tell me why that difference?
I can't tell you precisely. We were observers watching the price estimates come in from Turner Construction, and those estimates, we were told, are based upon Turner Construction, who specializes in stadiums and did the work at PG Park, as well as having built the Seahawks Stadium. So I do not know precisely what caused the $2 or $3 million increase.
And then there's the $2.5 million overrun that the city's guaranteeing in addition to that already, right?
That's correct. If there is an overrun beyond the now $89 million estimate, the first $2.5 million would be the city's.
And then there's a clause that says we would consider an exemption from public bidding by April to expedite this work. So have we decided that that's the construction company we're using?
No. What we're talking about is the bidding exemption would be something that would come before the council for you to consider without any prejudgment as to whether or not you would exempt from competitive bidding the construction contract that would be let in the future by Mr. Paulson's organization. And that's probably going to be a design-build contract, which means the design work, which is going to be starting soon on the current schedule, would be wrapped into that. So in order to have the same contractor do the design and the ultimate construction work, there would have to be fairly soon an exemption from public bidding, or else there would have to be the public bidding of that contract. If you choose not to exempt it, there will have to be public bidding. There are grounds for granting an exemption that are in the statute, and it'll be up to you to decide whether those grounds have been met.
Okay, thank you. And then another question on the proposed outline of the contract. It says that system development charges credits for demolition of the Memorial Coliseum will be applied, and then if after such credits, system development charges are charged on the stadium and the AAA, the city will be responsible for such SDCs. Is it not the case that we would be responsible also for the SDCs on the Memorial Coliseum demolition?
I don't believe there are any SDCs on the demolition itself. What we're talking about is the SDCs that are based upon transportation impacts, for example. If you knock down Memorial Coliseum, you're eliminating the transportation impact from 12,900 seats. If you replace that with only 9,000 seats, the net impact on transportation should be positive, not negative. So the idea is that those unused credits would be applied to the increase in the number of seats over at PG Park. But right now, there's really work to be done in detail on how the SDCs work, because there currently is not an SDC methodology that applies to a new public stadium.
Well, I'm concerned about that, because it sounded like what you just said is there's going to be fewer people going to the Rose Quarter with a stadium than there is currently for Memorial Coliseum. So I guess that's...
There will be fewer seats, because it will be taking a 12,900-seat facility and replacing it with a 9,000-seat facility.
Okay. I have some questions on the zero-coupon bonds. What would be the interest rate? Do we know, have a concept of that? And when would they be paid off?
I don't know if we have a really good bead on the interest rate. They'd be taxable. My understanding is that they would be taxable bonds, taxable municipal bonds, subject to state and federal taxes, so they wouldn't be exempt from federal income tax. They could be exempt from state income tax, but that probably won't make a big difference in the interest rate. Credit markets are really crummy right now, and we would expect that kind of taxable product and a zero coupon piece, which always prices at a premium, to be a very expensive piece of taxable finance. I think if we saw rates in the 8 or 9% range, that would not surprise me whatsoever. In terms of term of the bonds, the maximum terms that we've done with urban renewal has been 20 years, and I don't know that we would be able to extend the term any longer than that because of the peculiar constraints that we have with tax increment financing. Now, that may be a little bit different on the spectator side since we have zero coupons there, bonds as well. And the most that we would be going out on the spectator facilities side would be 25 years.
Okay, so then they would expire sometime in the 2020 period. And how would we pay off the balloon payments at the end with the interest?
Well, the way we're structuring the bonds is we're looking at the projection of revenues. Let's take, for example, spectator facilities. We're looking at a projection of revenues from spectator facilities that is designed so that when those revenues, and those revenues are projected to grow over time, that when the current bonds fall away, which is 2017, the Rose Quarter bonds are expired, or matured rather, that the zero coupon bonds, as they mature, are scheduled to increase at a rate that's consistent with our projection of revenue, so they will match up that cash flow over time.
Okay, and is the spectator fund, the use of that money, is that limited? Could that the money that is paid into the spectator fund, can that only be used for spectator facilities, or could it come into the general fund?
I believe as long as bonds are outstanding, it's limited to the spectator facilities.
But once they're not?
It's possible, but that would be sometime down the road.
But if we didn't take out more, if we didn't borrow more, then the current bonds on the Rose Quarter would expire when?
Right now, 2017 is when the current set of bonds are scheduled to expire. Now, we also backstop the PGE Park bonds with Spectator Facilities Funds revenue, so we would be careful about making sure that those bonds are paid off also. And I think that they mature in 2024. Okay.
Okay, and then my last question, at least for right now. You mentioned that the short term, that the borrowing for the $15 million in the new urban renewal district that hasn't been created yet would be from the general fund or backed by the general fund?
Correct.
So does that mean we have to have a general fund set aside for those? Or would that actually take money out of what I can spend on other services?
Generally, the answer to that is no, because what we typically do is when we're fronting for an urban renewal district, and we do this quite a bit, this is not unusual, is in advance of the increment arriving, we actually do a general fund back borrowing, give those proceeds to PDC, And interest on that line of credit is also paid through the line of credit facility. So we actually have an arrangement with the bank that we can make draws to pay interest when due. When increment grows to a sufficient level, then we take out that line of credit borrowing with a long-term tax increment financing. So the structure is designed, while backed by the general fund, to not have a general fund financial resource claim during the time that it's outstanding.
Okay. Thank you. And I have one question for Lou, and that is for the affordable housing 30% set aside for the Oregon Convention Center District, have we already satisfied that? And with the $18 million that's going to be added in borrowing, would we have to have another portion of that for more affordable housing?
The current agreement in the OCC is that there would be a 26% affordable housing set aside. So if this were an increase to the budget, then there would be an additional affordable housing requirement.
And was that taken into account when setting the amount that would need to be borrowed with the zero coupon bonds?
What we've contemplated between Randy Leonard, Commissioner Leonard and myself is about a 4.8 requirement, and that we would make up for that on the west side in the creation of the new urban renewal district.
Thank you.
I had a question. I've been looking for that number on the Spectator Fund bonds. What percentage is going to do you estimate will of the $31 million? How much of that is going to be from arena facility activities, and how much from anticipated AAA?
The rose quarter of the $31 million of financing. Our estimates, and I can give it to you the dollar if you'd like. It's 21. But I'll round it to $21 million for is the estimate, but we have a pretty precise projection of that.
For the arena?
That would be backed by Rose Quarter revenues. PG Park and AAA.
Oh, $21 million. Okay. And how much of the $21 million is coming from the Blazers versus?
When the dust would settle on this deal, the city would have about $28.5 million outstanding for the existing PG Park and then $31 million of additional borrowing for these new projects. About 40% of that would be from the Rose Quarter activity paid for, not part of the guarantee. About 40% of that would be guaranteed by AAA and MLS-related revenues, and about 20% would come from the existing agreement we have with the Visitor Development Initiative to contribute money to the debt service payments on the existing PG Park bonds.
So just an estimate, because I know definitive agreements will get us to a firm number, but the estimated value of the guarantee that Merritt Paulson and his family will have to make, the dollar amount related to the Rose Quarter and new soccer stadium at PGE of the $31 million source?
It's about $9 million for that.
$9 million, okay. And then on the, you talked about the so the rest of that is from the anticipated proceeds of continuing a Blazer and arena operations.
Correct.
And we talked around the table of making sure in terms of managing that risk that we have adequate contingencies. Let's say that there's an NBA lockout for 3 years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we've always been concerned about the Rose Quarter in terms of the dominant use by the Blazers and what impact their activity would have on us. And so we have a full year in reserve in the operating fund equivalent to what the Blazers produce, because they're 55-60% of the total revenues at the Rose Garden. In fact, we had to use that 1 year when there was a lockout, right when the Rose Quarter opened. And I think within a year or so, there was a lockout that affected revenues. So we're very mindful of that experience and do have money set aside for that. We've also been mindful of that as we've gone through kind of a slow period with the Trailblazers as their fortunes sort of turned south and now seem to be headed back up. And so we have some reserves created for that, Mayor, that are designed to help protect the city's general fund and the other revenues that are pledged to the bonds that we've issued for that particular project.
Thank you. Any other questions from Council?
I have a few, and I had not seen the revised contract till this morning, so I'm going to try to operate within the ground rules of reviewing a proposed contract for a $128 million deal in the 3 hours that's been set aside for Council to do this. I want to start with Steve Janik. Steve, you've described a process where we're being asked to sign off on a document which has about 6 or 7 major contingencies in them that, if not satisfied, allow us to pull out of the deal.
Correct.
So you know, as a council, we're used to actually voting on contracts to do something. What is this called? If it, what is this deal that you're asked, that we are being asked to vote on today?
It's not an agreement. It's a outline of business terms that will then form the framework for the definitive documents as we move forward. And this is exactly what happened in the case of the Rose Garden.
So I'm just struggling with what this is. We're being asked to give the green light to what is, in effect, a further negotiation?
Right. You're being asked to approve a framework deal structure that contains within it many contingencies so that the parties can move forward to negotiate the definitive documents and so that Mr. Paulson can go to Major League Soccer and say that if you award me a franchise, here are the parameters, not a binding situation, but the parameters of an agreement with the city for the facilities.
So armed with this, that, and you've artfully described a huge number of opt-outs for us,
right,
if certain things don't happen. Armed with this, Mr. Paulson goes to MLS tomorrow, and they decide as of Monday to award a franchise, and then the city council, by September 1, learns that the financing doesn't pencil out and pulls the plug on the deal, then what happens?
That's the reality. There won't be a deal, and the city won't have any liability.
What happens to the franchise?
That's for Mr. Paulson and MLS to decide.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that all we're doing here is authorizing Merritt to make a proposal to Major League Soccer. This isn't an obligation beyond indicating our intentions to try to enter into an agreement. Yeah. But at any point that we decide we're not satisfied with any of the conditions, we can pull out.
Well, I think Commissioner Leonard for that, because I've been trying to figure out what this is, and that sounds as clear a statement as what this is. So, but nonetheless, we're being asked to make a judgment about some terms, some of which I've not seen before. So I have a few questions I'd like to ask just to get answers. And
go ahead.
You understand, Carla, there are 44 people waiting to testify?
We're going to be here a while.
So I'd like to ask you, what does a personal guarantee mean?
Personal guarantee is a legal document by which the person who signs it guarantees somebody else's performance or payment obligation, and therefore it becomes their obligation.
So if a person signs a personal guarantee, I assume that it's after we've looked at their
correct
net worth statement.
Correct.
And Steve, I'm familiar in construction context, there's a performance bond,
right,
which is obtained to make sure that if there's a breach, you get your money. How do you collect on a personal guarantee?
It's easy. You file a lawsuit.
Okay.
And, I mean, in your case, in the construction world, there are two types of bonds. There are payment bonds and there are performance bonds. Performance means the bonding company will complete the job. Okay. Payment bond means they will pay any subcontractors that didn't get paid. And it's very difficult sometimes to collect from a bonding company. In the case of a personal guarantee, you have an individual who has pledged all of their net worth, all of their assets, and all you have to do to collect on a personal guarantee is to file a lawsuit. And the issue is, was the guaranteed payment made? If not, that's the end of the subject. You would then be able, with a judgment, you would have a judgment against all of their real and personal property and assets, wherever located, and the judgment has a 10-year duration, which can be renewed periodically until it's satisfied.
And I'm guessing in any lawsuit, Mr. Paulson could say that he's not on the hook because the city might have breached one of its obligations.
No, we're not going to accept a conditional guarantee like that.
So it'll be a guarantee that where he waives any defenses?
He would waive any defenses to the guarantee. If he felt that we had somehow breached our obligation, he'd be able to separately pursue that under the legal structure that we would put in place. But remember, the guarantee doesn't go into effect until the facilities are all built. And I don't think on an ongoing basis, after the facilities are built, the city's going to have any responsibilities other than to honor the operating agreement that lets him operate in those facilities.
Under the proposed deal, who pays for the demolition of Memorial Coliseum?
That demolition is included in the estimated cost of $89 million.
So, Ken Rust, we have about $5 million in our contingency in that Spectators Fund.
Well, there's a total of about $6.5 million, $2.5 million, which would be the capital reserve account, and about $4 million, which is our operating reserve.
And we're contemplating taking $2.5 million and applying it potentially to a cost overrun pool?
If necessary.
If necessary.